Welcome to the latest episode of the IDEA podcast from the Irish Development Education Association. I'm your host, Eimear Green, and today's episode features the first panel session from our virtual conference, Rising to the Challenge, Global Citizenship in 2020. We have five wonderful speakers exploring the questions, how did we get here? 2020 has brought seismic changes, our lives are in flux, systemic inequality is in the spotlight, and our response to the looming economic and climate crises hangs in the balance. What systems, approaches and responses are at play, and what is and isn't working? The panel is moderated by Stephen Farley, Post-Primary Development Education Officer with Throcra. I hope you enjoy.
So I'm delighted to introduce the first speaker today, Dr. Lorna Gold. So Dr. Lorna is a former colleague of mine in Throcra, worked with Throcra for many years. And we're going to be hearing from Lorna about the climate crisis, the current situation, how we got here, and what is and isn't working. So Lorna is a climate activist and lectures in the Department of Applied Social Sciences over at Maynooth University, beside us there in Throcra. Lorna holds a PhD in Economic Geography from University of Glasgow and is Vice Chair of the Board of the Global Catholic Climate Movement and a member of the recently established Vatican Commission on the Post-COVID World. Lorna will speak to us about the climate crisis, the current situation, how we got here and what isn't working. So Lorna, if you're happy to begin.
Yeah, thanks, Stephen. It's great to be here and to see so many familiar faces in the audience. So it's really a great conference as well. I'm going to speak actually more broadly, try and address some of these questions, because I think a theme that's going to emerge this morning is interconnection. Everything is interconnected. So I think we can all agree we're living in the strangest of times. At times we're all wondering what might happen next, not just on Zoom, but more broadly in the world. What's going to happen next between the growing climate and ecological crisis and the pandemic, obviously, and then the madness we see in terms of political projects such as Brexit and Trump. On top of that, we see a mounting financial crisis, and the stark reality is that if businesses can't get back to normal, some kind of normality soon, so governments are not going to be able to sustain debt levels, and the job losses and the ability to pay for social services, health services in the longer term is going to really reach a crunch point. And I think as we're heading into this winter in particular, there's a growing sense of a gathering storm in our world today. It appears, certainly from my own perspective, that time seems to have sped up and at the same time slowed down in strange ways. In the face of this, there are plenty of reasons to despair. I think we are witnessing amongst people an overwhelming sense of powerlessness. And when you think back to the fact that only a year ago, the tremendous sense of power and agency that young people were experiencing in terms of the climate marches and the sense of engagement in politics and citizenship, it's very tragic to see the growing levels of powerlessness and despair as we're seeing these crises intertwine. You just need to think about the pictures we're seeing on our television screens this year of people facing unprecedented forest fires or hurricanes and trying to deal with those emergencies while in face masks and social distancing in the midst of another crisis. The problems, these just seem too big, and responses are too late to stop this sense of an intertwining crisis. In many ways, it can seem like we're edging towards two cliffs of economic meltdown and climate meltdown. And the sense of agency as global citizens can seem lost. How did we get here? And that's a very depressing picture, and I won't end on the depressing picture for sure. But how did we get here? And obviously, in a two-minute discussion, hopefully the whole morning we can discuss this. But I just want to pinpoint a couple of reasons why we're here, like root causes. I think the current situation, whilst hugely complex, and there's many causes, there stems from from quite simple yet profoundly misplaced assumptions that have come to dominate our lives in society. And these simple assumptions have huge implications. The first is that it is possible to grow the economy infinitely on a finite planet. And the corollary of this is that market principles, narrowly defined in terms of profitability, are the most efficient mechanism to distribute finite world resources, or infinite world resources, if you believe that assumption. The second assumption is that human activity is primarily driven by self-seeking individuals, not as collectives acting for the common good. These two assumptions take primacy in so many levels of society, decision-making, and public narratives. The deeper problem underpinning these is one of fragmentation of knowledge at all levels of our society and the prevalence of one way of knowing over all others, one paradigm that dominates the other paradigms. It's not that the evidence to counter these basic assumptions doesn't exist. It exists in spades. You just have to look outside the door of a narrowly defined economic paradigm to see that other ways of thinking, being, planning, problem solving exist. However, our business world, our politics, and our lives to some extent are dominated, if not suffocated, by this narrow values framework. So where do we move forward in this? And obviously that's a very succinct summary. In the midst of this madness, and I define it as a madness, it's like a psychosis we're facing today, I want to focus on the idea of hope, of cultivating hope. Where can we find hope? And we urgently need to find this in ourselves, in each other, and in society. As time is short, I'll just point to three areas that give me hope in view of coming up with and promoting an ecosystem of hope. Whilst this paradigm is so prevailing, there's a deep sense of rupture in this prevailing paradigm. There are many people, institutions, and initiatives that are truly responding to this deep-rooted economic tunnel vision and fragmentation. I'll just name them just now and we can discuss them later. The first is the culture of local neighbourliness, friendship and kindness that has emerged and broken through this paradigm of self-interest during the pandemic. One of the challenges we face now is to say, how can this become the new normal? The second is a whole new school of economic thinking on how we can live within the earth systems and build a sustainable and just economy, the donut economy model. And the third area that I would highlight is the translation of the divestment movement and the ethical screening movement into the rise of a new values-based investor movement. In conclusion, at this juncture in history, we need to choose which future we want to be part of. As Joanna Macy famously said, we need to decide, are we part of the great unravelling or the great turning? And I personally think that we'll look back on 2020 and realise that the falling apart we're seeing today had to happen in order for the great turning to come about. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lorna. That's fantastic. Really excellent points there, and you know, serious food for thought for when we go into the breakout rooms. This idea of a gathering storm is hard to get away from, but I love that idea of cultivating hope, and I mean, and that's what we're all trying to do with DevEd, I hope so, and making sure that we choose that right future. So thank you very much for that, Lorna, and I'm sorry for chivving you along there with the time. Okay, so next we're going to go to Amelia Peterson. So Amelia is an assistant country director and head of programs for Golden Zimbabwe, an expert in environmental law and development, and her current role gives her oversight of all Gold's Zimbabwe programs, which reach over 500,000 people. So Amelia, if you're happy to kick off.
Thank you so much for the invitation. I've titled this very brief conversation and presentation, Climate Change, COVID and Cohesion. which I see, at least in our experience as GOAL in Zimbabwe, we really see as a triple threat to ending poverty, or at least making a dent in poverty in Zimbabwe. I'm sure most of you in the room are familiar with GOAL. GOAL is an Irish international NGO. Those of us in Zimbabwe actually feel really honored to be able to speak to this panel this morning, knowing that it's probably a room mostly filled with Irish people, for which we're extremely grateful that this international NGO has reached parts of the world like Zimbabwe with some fantastic work. You may or may not know, GOAL has been operational since the late 70s. Its mission really focused on helping the most vulnerable people in the world to survive crisis. And we do that through humanitarian work and development work as well. So let's take a little bit of a look at Zimbabwe, and this being just a little bit of background as we go into this discussion around how we got here, sort of where we are, how we got here, and then thinking through the COVID pandemic and opportunities. The GOAL Zimbabwe operation has a staff of about 150, which in terms of size of international NGOs makes us about a mid-size NGO in the Zimbabwean landscape, alongside organizations like World Vision and CARE and Plan International. Operations in Zimbabwe began early 2000s. As I've already touched on briefly, our programs focus on both humanitarian work, which is sort of your emergency, immediate, after an acute emergency or an acute crisis kind of work. And we also do some development programming, mostly funded through Irish Aid. The sectors that we focus on are food security and livelihoods. We look at health, nutrition. We also look at water, sanitation, and hygiene, which, as you can imagine, have become extremely important during this COVID pandemic, targeting both rural and urban. Just some really interesting facts. Over the last, I would say, maybe 20 years of development work in Zimbabwe, it's been quite clear that the vulnerability that most NGOs look at is around the rural landscape. But over the last 2 years, it's become quite clear, and statistics are now, assessments have now been done to give data and numbers behind this phenomenon of a growing urban food insecurity. And as of last major sort of national assessment, about 38% of Zimbabweans were considered food insecure. And these are urban dwelling Zimbabweans, which is a really high figure. We have 11 active grants. We're a pretty active office, and our donors range from, as I've already mentioned, Irish Aid, as well as the UN agencies, the AFDB, the EU, as well as foundations like the Garden Trust. So when we really try to take a look at how we got where we are, or the systems that are in place to get us where we are, first of all, we have the rural system, so to speak, which is largely agrarian. And unfortunately, climate change comes in. We have recurring droughts. I think Zimbabwe is in its fifth year of drought, which actually came on the heels of an El Nino. Prior to that, other sort of long periods of drought. So maybe every 2-3 years are followed by 4 to 5 years of drought. So absolutely destructive in terms of the agrarian economy that we look at when we look at the rural system of livelihood. When we look at the urban system, we are looking at high unemployment, but also a huge percentage or proportion of informal employment. So when the COVID pandemic came upon us, for Zimbabweans, the lockdowns had really, really adverse impact on lively communities, because when you say 80% of people are informally employed, it means they need to be out on the streets in order to make their livelihoods. They need to be out on the streets selling, buying and selling, in order for them to eat on any given day. Another system I think that really sort of maps how we got where we are is the system of migration. Zimbabwe is no stranger to migration. There's rural, urban, urban, rural migration. There's also regional migration. These systems, sort of the migration patterns, really hugely impacted by lockdown restrictions and the closing of borders, so that communities that once could sort of go up and down between Zimbabwe and, say, South Africa or Botswana or Mozambique for their shopping, to access, you know, less pricey goods or to trade in their various produce and wares, that hasn't existed for the last 6 months. So it's both rural and urban populations affected by the migration system that has been adversely impacted by lockdowns and restrictions. And then lastly, I think an important system in the Zimbabwean context is social norms, right? We're talking about cohesion, the inequalities between men and women, whether we're looking at the rural landscape, the urban landscape, or the lens is migration itself. We see traditional social norms where women cannot hold certain kinds of wealth, women cannot own cattle, they can only own smaller livestock. Women cannot, because of protection issues, cannot be involved in certain kinds of economic activity like mining, which is a pretty big thing in Zimbabwe now, informal mining, in the informal mining sector. So I think these four systems really look at, allow us to really look at how we got where we are. So when we look at what GOAL is doing in Zimbabwe, and I'll go through these next few slides very quickly because they're really just about the pictures. Here's a picture of a community that we've reached with small livestock, with a huge emphasis on men becoming involved in small livestock, because the system of social norms says women do small livestock, men do large livestock, and already there's an economic imbalance there. So, we've been able to see some successes regardless of the lockdowns, regardless of the restrictions brought about by COVID, by the closing of borders. For example, really quick one here, our smallholder livestock farmers and improving breeds. We found that we need to focus on programming that can operate in a sense just within the community without needing that sort of up and down or connections to the cities, connections to the private sector. While they are important, in the lockdown, we found that communities were cut off from those systems. And it's very important for programming to focus around what the community itself can build up from where they are. So I'll just skip to the bottom points. More resources for the same impact, reduced monitoring of activities. These are some of the impacts that we've seen in the COVID pandemic. And then, as I've said, this recognition that community structures should really have been empowered or capacitated even more than we have done.
Thank you so much, Milia. That was a really interesting presentation, really relevant to what we're talking about today. So we're going to move on to listen to Gavin Titley now. So Gavin, many of you will know, works in Maynooth University in the Department of Media Studies, and his research would broadly focus on questions of racism and media and communications, most recent book being Is Free Speech Racist? An extremely interesting question. So Gavin will be speaking to us about populist and racist narratives and how this has happened. So Gavin, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'm actually going to talk more about media, actually, is what I passed on and be talking about, but we certainly inevitably come to those kinds of questions as well. Thank you very much for the invitation to speak here. It's a really refreshing space and a refreshingly blunt question. 2020, how did we get here? I started 2020 in Australia, where I was up very close with these extraordinary cataclysmic bushfires, which Lauren already mentioned. And I remember thinking that this is what it's like to experience the impact of a global crisis up close. And I had no idea really that 2020 was just getting started when I was observing what was going on there. But I think, of course, we can use 2020 as a marker. but we can overplay it in terms of trying to understand where we are with this intersection of different crises that Lorna laid out so well, from a very particular kind of economic crisis, which is not just a crisis of profit and overproduction, but an ideological crisis. I think it's very important to emphasize that, to the varying impacts of climate change and human movement, which we also heard in the last presentation, to crises of political representation and the attractions of authoritarianism, which, Stephen, you mentioned, and certainly has a lot to do with what I'm going to talk about here. What I think is important is to be able to try to understand or approach the intersection of these as different systemic crises that accelerate each other and that exacerbate each other. And it's for that reason, this short comment, that I wanted to just focus on one system that in some ways plays through all of these different interconnecting systemic crises that we're trying to analyze at the moment. And that is, in a sense, the globalized media system, or we could even call it an ecosystem these days, which has always been, I suppose, very, in my experience, my limited experience of development education, has always been very central to thinking about development education. Media, in very basic ways, circulate meaning. They have a role to play every day, but also in spectacular ways. They have a role to play in making our lives meaningful, making our sense of the world meaningful. So in terms of thinking about global citizenship, the challenge of media has always been to understand its ambivalent potential. On the one hand, media has the capacity to increase a sense of interconnection, which is, I see, one of the key themes people have been talking about, and even increase a sense or an ethics of interdependence, an experience of being part of a shared world, if you like, while also, of course, feeding into the circulation of stereotypes, myths, accelerating antagonisms, all of these which have been key themes in development education, and looking, for example, at the representations of development or the developing world, inverted commas. Now, what's very clear and has what clearly fed into many of the crises that we're trying to analyze is that over the last few years, the question of interconnection has become much more structured into politics, structured into everyday life, in that digital media provide us with an unprecedented infrastructure of connection. One that is mobile, one that is ubiquitous, one that is inviting us through very many seductive corporate platforms to be part of an increased density of connections and a speed of connection in a very profound, everyday sort of way. Now, this, of course, has been around for a couple of years. And one thing that was very noticeable in the last while is that broadly, if we were having this discussion 8 years ago, there would be a much more positive, much more hopeful, even kind of utopian approach to social media or to digital media, thinking of the ways in which they allow for very much more horizontal networking, the bypassing of different kinds of gatekeepers, the ways in which they allow different sorts of social movements and political movements, particularly in Southern Europe, in the Caucasus, in North Africa, to organize in ways which were unprecedented in that moment. Obviously, we fast forward a few years and start thinking about 2019, 2020, particularly under the influence of the current US presidency. And this narrative, if you like, of what social media, what digital media is and what it does, has become much more dystopian. It's very clear that media play and can play an increased role in exacerbating political and social conflicts and crises. And we can see this in the kind of vocabulary that is suddenly floating around, asking us to try to make sense of what's going on. We're talking about misinformation, fake news, post-truth, filter bubbles, and so on, terms which may be familiar to a lot of people. So I think what's going on at the moment is that when we think about the media ecosystem and the way that it plays through the different systemic crises we're trying to analyze, we're sort of struggling to capture and to analyze the ways in which these media systems provide political actors, often non-traditional political actors, and you mentioned sort of fascistic and authoritarian political actors centrally, provide them with new opportunity structures, and in fact benefit forms of reactionary politics much more than patient, progressive, coalition building, collective understanding, and so forth. And the second thing also mentioned by Lorna when she talked about the sort of fragmentation of meaning in everyday life is that the more generally, outside of things that are happening politically, the informational system that we live in, which people, of course, have very unequal access to and very unequal integration into, but nevertheless creates problems of developing common understandings, not agreement, not consensus, but common understandings on the social realities that we inhabit and what that means for action. So I just want to say a couple of things about that to wrap up and try to stay to the time. I think we have a challenge in trying to integrate thinking about media ecosystems into our evaluation of these intersecting crises, because we have to think hard about the terms of our inclusion. And I'd sort of put up two notes of warning, if you like. One thing we need to be able to do, and it sounds a little bit paradoxical, but we need to be able to explain the significance of media without putting media at the center of everything, without being media-centric about our explanations, without overestimating the power, while also thinking about the new forms of power which have been created at the moment. For example, take anti-mask protests in Europe. These are very clearly a product of online networking. These political formations wouldn't exist without social media, but they're happening in a context of social crisis, and it's a social crisis which is layered into a neoliberal crisis, that is a lack of faith or a crisis of faith in the state and in governance to provide for people's basic needs and to provide a sense of social, of a viable social future. The second thing is, I think we need to be able to evaluate the negative consequences of this media ecosystem without nostalgia, without thinking or without depending on an idea of a golden age of good media, which we have moved past, because, of course, those media systems and those media histories were also very ambivalent in much the same ways and often characterized by unaccountable power of all kinds. So if we're looking at the current moment, I think we need to think about two aspects of this ecosystem that are playing into systemic crises in a variety of ways. One is clearly just the speed and density and ubiquity of connection and what this means for political mobilization. So if we have a look at precisely, as Stephen mentioned, very sort of headline authoritarian movements and leaders and moments in the world at the moment, they have benefited in unexpected ways and also in very predictable ways from the proliferation of social media. So in unexpected ways, for example, you can think about the use of WhatsApp in Brazil and India, a chat app which suddenly becomes a sort of a channel of propaganda. In predictable ways, it was always predictable that a platform like Facebook would lead to the kinds of problems that it has led to, because its business model is the production and circulation of discourse among as many points of contact and interconnection as possible in order to create profit. So the first problem I think we have is that within different scales of activity, local, regional, national, global, transnational, we depend on a kind of pseudo-public infrastructure, that is private corporations who provide us with the possibility to do often very interesting and positive things, but also in terms of this ambivalence, very negative and very destructive things. And we need to think about their accountability. We need to think about how to make communications democratically accountable. The second point I would finish on is that we also have something of a crisis in the way that we think about the relationship between information, knowledge, and publics. There is so much information, there is so much fragmentation, as Lorna said, that it is now very, very difficult to build up shared meanings, shared understandings from which we can act. So I think a role for education, a role for activists, is to try to think about how can we host, how can we cultivate different kinds of conversations where collective meanings can be generated, where the sort of practical understanding of the kind of hope that Lorna is talking about can be cultivated in ways that can be sustained. So I think there's a lot we need to think about at the level of public infrastructure and political intervention, but also collective and individual efforts around creating good practices. Thank you very much.
Okay, Gavin, that's brilliant. Such a fascinating area, the media. I'm always reminded of that movie Sneakers, which was back in 1992, and the guy in it said, it's not about who has the most weapons, it's about who controls the information, and that so resonates so much right now. Okay, listen, thanks very much, Gavin. We're just going to move on now to Valerie. So Valerie Mole is a climate justice officer with the MICI and the Youth 2030 program, which us in Troker are very familiar with, and also an outgoing Irish UN youth delegate. And Valerie is going to talk to us today about the role of development education in tackling racism, looking at systems, approaches, and responses to date. So Valerie, if you're ready.
Thank you so much, Stephen.
Thank you.
It's very good for me to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me, IDEA, to share my thoughts and experience a little bit in how I see our society, how I see our world, and what is going on. Like Stephen said, so I do embed myself within the global citizenship education. And I think one of the elements of global citizenship education is all about the interconnection of our world, the interdependence of our world, speaking a lot about how unequal our world is, challenging perspective. So with critical thinking, but also more importantly, I should say, really about conscious action is also a need there. So thinking about, so when I think about all of this stuff at the same time, and I think about the question of how did we get here, very hard to summarize one particular element or many concrete point as such, because like all the other speakers I've already said, all of these systemic issues are basically playing with each other. They're so interconnected. But I'm going to try and sort of point out some element that I think are very much at the front or at the core of the issues that we're facing today. So I'm going to name a few things, and then I'm going to speak about them as I go along. So I want to talk about neoliberalism, or should I say this unchecked or unquestioned of neoliberal principles. So the market can solve everything. The market is the solution to everything kind of thing. This idea of unchecked growth beyond our planetary boundaries. Already Lorna has already talked about it a little by mentioning the donut economy, but very much has been driving and still driving our society or our system today. What I would call a failure of decolonization. So the idea that we wanted to, well, we talked about colonialism ending, slavery ending, but have we actually done it? Did we fail along the line of doing it? That's it. And then the last point would be the gap between what we all envision as a fair world and an equal world and actually the ability, or I don't want to say the will, because I think it's beyond the will, that how ready we are to actually cross that bridge, swim that cold water to get to the other side, which will mean certainly to sit within our uncomfortableness, challenge yourself, give away some power that we have, because all of this also at the core is very much about basically the role of power, or who believe they have power, who actually has power, who's leading on to the power, who cannot recognize the power anymore, that they feel so trapped. This is also part of the play. So going back again to this whole idea of the markets can solve everything, we've seen, and the result of it is not just with our climate crisis, as we see, because of course, clearly the market has missed the point of natural resources and making sure that we're accounting for it for a long period of time. That's what we've done. We've lived as if we were living in a finite planet with all the resources that is never ending. But as we can tell right now, that's not the case, and we're paying the prices for it, and some people are paying more of a prices than others once more. But also the whole idea of market solving anything can also be portrayed or seen when we think about jobs today in our society, especially when we think about COVID. It's very clear that there's a lot of there's a lot of jobs that had been, in my opinion, I could even say denigrated, put aside as lower, left out of society, but actually had more value in terms of supporting society, supporting people, that has not been recognized. So if you think about the salaries, you think about who is actually benefiting, what is their contribution, what is their work they're doing, how much of value is put into their work, but how much of their work is actually contributing to the value of society. Once again, I think the market has failed us in that sense. Once again, to support, yet again, it's really, and that kind of links well with this idea of growth. And the impact of that has also been reflected within our education system, where we've moved away from knowledge to supporting people to acquire knowledge, to critically think about the society, think about their neighbor, think about their action within to actually creating machines of people because people want to survive. And I'm not even I'm not blaming anyone, because as a young person myself going through college and having that question, should I pick something because I know I'm going to get a job out of it at the end that is going to make me secure, or should I pick something because I basically I need to contribute to society? And to talk about decolonization, once again, it's very much at that point or that question of raising that, how ready are we to basically challenge the white gaze, or to challenge this idea of peace, some people are superior than other, and how much of that has been impacting our decision or education system or society, how we see the rest of the world. So if we constantly see people as less off, how are they ever going to contribute in our society? And I want to just end within that decolonization point and talk about Sarah Hammett's point, where she said that that individuals and institutions that commit to anti-racism often continue to reproduce racism, but paradoxically mobilize their stated commitment as proof that they are no longer racist. So the mere fact that you say that I'm working on anti-racism and I'm working on decolonizing my practice doesn't necessarily mean that you're actually doing it. You're probably continuously perpetrating. How many of us are still willing to sort of think, critically think, but also consciously act on those actions, whether it makes us uncomfortable or not? So these are the little things that I thought basically contributes to the systemic issues that we have today. And I look forward to continuing this conversation in breakout rooms. Thank you so much, Stephen.
Thank you very much, Valerie. That was amazing. Some excellent points in there that I think we can really get into in the breakout rooms. The idea of critical thinking leading to conscious action, I think, is something we're all trying to certainly achieve. And the issues around neoliberalism, the failure of decolonization, and then the thing that resonates the most with me there, this gap between what we know to be a fair and equal world and how can we cross that bridge to get there. I think that's one of the fundamental questions we need to get into, and how to give away some of that power that we all seem to want to hold on to. Fantastic, Valerie. Thank you very much. We're now going to move on to our last speaker. So our last speaker is Anastasia Crickley. So Anastasia is chairperson of Pavey Point Traveller and Roma Centre and former chairperson of the UN Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. So Anastasia is going to be speaking to us about the impact of COVID-19, the climate crisis and racism on marginalised and minority groups. And we're delighted to have Anastasia with us. So Anastasia, if you're ready.
Thank you. Thank you, Stephen. Now, other people have spoken very eloquently about a variety of the things that I had hoped to talk about. So what I'm going to do is very briefly just make a few comments for myself, talk a little bit about how we got there, talk a little bit about the context of COVID, and then raise a few suggestions about civil society overall. And I want to do so as someone who believes very strongly that those of us who've had the privilege of being analysts also need to be activists and also need to be actively involved in the action and building collaboration and going beyond collaboration to build integration globally around the issues that we're speaking to. I was reminded earlier when Lorna was speaking about the SDGs and reminded about the struggle that we had to get those SDGs at a global level to reflect anything about human rights. So I'd like to suggest to you that maybe as we look for implementation of the SDGs, we need to go back beyond them, and we need to look to the commitments, the human rights, the global human rights commitments that states have made globally, and ensure that those are the bedrock from which the SDGs are implemented, because otherwise they become slightly meaningless, particularly since they're not all as well grounded in human rights as they'd need to be. Secondly, I'm very struck by the importance at this point in time of language. And Stephen, if you don't mind me saying so, I'm a little concerned that we would refer to people as naturally vulnerable. I think we need to be very careful, because I think what's happened, particularly through COVID, is that conditions have been created whereby people's are defined as vulnerable. None of us are born vulnerable. Just because I'm a woman, I'm not born vulnerable. And I do believe that we need to be very careful to not make assumptions about that. And to, on the other hand, to also avoid terms like, say, for advantage, for example, disadvantaged communities, rather than marginalized communities. I'd suggest to you that in most global contexts, disadvantage is not an automatic condition that anyone finds themselves in. Now, so my second starting point then, or my third starting point, is that I believe also that in consideration of development education and the parallels between ITSE and community development and development work, I think we've managed to collaborate, but what we haven't managed to do, and if I was to say one of the challenges for now, for COVID 2020, I think one of the challenges that we face is the need to go beyond that sort of collaboration to integration of these issues. For example, at the moment, a key issue that will be affecting the communities that many of you are concerned about is the issue of the new EU migration framework. I'm not sure how many of us or how many of you have actually raised that question with the EU and with Ireland's stand with regard to that new EU migration framework, which pretends to actually create a more equal situation, but in effect will have the possibility of marginalising further groups, in particular those from sub-Saharan Africa. Now, in terms of context, and already Gavin, Lorna, Amelia and Valerie have spoken to this, I think the global capitalist system we have, which is one of global growth alongside globally growing inequalities and a polarisation of income and wealth, so that wealth has grown exponentially, raises a huge challenge at the moment. And from the point of view of the organisations that many of us are concerned with, that's been reflected in systems of governance, not just organisational governance, but also national governance, be seen as co-option and control, so that certainties and cemented identities have become very much the order of the day. And it's very easy to point to the USA and to Trump as a good example of that. But it certainly has become a globalized phenomenon in the last while. I'm very conscious of the way that has also affected all of us as women globally, and has affected the way in which we're perceived and the way in which our progress has been seen as something, say, for example, in the Irish context, that's addressed as women in politics. I have to say, my question is, which women, in what politics, and in whose interests? To speak then to an issue that I have been involved in and with and in all my life, and acknowledging fully Valerie's concerns about it, I think she's absolutely right that part of our problem with racism is that we haven't really addressed the ways in which it continues. I'm suggesting to you that it is, in fact, a toxic global discourse which divides, marginalizes, and legitimates hatred and superiority. I suggest, though, that at the moment, if racism is racism, and racism, in effect, are preferences and exclusions based on race, colour, descent, national and ethnic origin, which has the purpose or the effect, and I'm quoting from the UN definition, which is the one that Ireland has agreed and 182 states have now agreed to be bound by, has the purpose or effect of denying or impairing human rights or fundamental economic, social, political or cultural freedoms. And I think why it's important to use that is that its purpose or effect, and as Valerie said many times with regard to racism, it's the effects of racism. In spite of the best intentions of those who continue to ignore the legacies of slavery and colonization, and also the continued discrimination, in fact, the legitimized discrimination in Europe in particular against travelers and Roma. So used to demonize groups, justify oppression, and institutionally embedded, I'd suggest to you, as someone who's dealt with virtually all of them in all of the countries, in many, all of the countries globally, in ways that are sometimes ignored. Moving along then to COVID-19 and its implications. Clearly, what COVID-19 has done is to reinforce communitarianism. Now, Lorna spoke to this as reinforcing neighbourliness, and I'd speak to it also in an Irish context and elsewhere as reinforcing essential humanity and essential contact between people. But I'd suggest to you it's also reinforced a particular view of communitarianism, which is more about control than about going the road less traveled, more about ensuring that people in communities know their place and stay in it, more about ensuring that the GAA, for example, in the Irish context, gives out parcels to local white, marginalized, disadvantaged, or otherwise women of my age, but doesn't really go beyond that to looking to community power, community control, and community infrastructure. Reinforce sense of essential caring, and maybe cementing rather than cracking the status quo, creating a narrative in the interests of only one group, in a sense, moving from community work to community control, I'd suggest to you. So I think in looking to our responses at the moment, you know, we can't have too rosy tinted a spectacle look at what's been happening during COVID-19. And we do have an opportunity because the importance of community, the importance of that sense of neighbourliness globally is now seen and understood. But it's seen and understood as something that can be controlled and as something that can be used to go in a very particular direction. It's an opportunity as well as an option, as well as some optics for civil society. But if civil society, of which all of us are part, is to make any sense of it, we need to deal with the internal hierarchies as well as external controls. And for example, in community work terms, and I've already raised that, it's a question of what language we use. It's where language has somehow replaced understanding. The language of community has become very important globally in dealing with the pandemic. The language, though, has very successfully replaced an understanding of community and community work and the people who are in communities having a right to have a say and a right to be part of the decisions that are made. Communities are included rather than accommodated rather than included. Moving on then fairly quickly, I'd suggest that in order to move this forward, we need to look at civil society relations. In that context, I'd suggest perhaps looking at the relations that we're part of in this conference, whether we're Irish, whether we're globally located outside of Ireland, and where we fit with that. Looking at civil society state relations, taking a rights-based approach with collective outcomes, acknowledging the complexities and the contradictions, because I think there are many. For example, I was thinking of Gavin's work earlier on racism and the media and the work that we did in CERD as part of developing the CERD's General Recommendation 35 on hate speech and the need to accommodate those sorts of complexities in the various situations that we're dealing with. I'm also conscious of the complexities that have been faced by travellers and Roma in Ireland, particularly Roma, who have been disproportionately affected by the ravages of COVID-19 and for whom institutional racism was temporarily suspended in order to create conditions where they could have places to live, but has now reared itself again, and very much so. Doing that, we need to address women's oppression and also take on board movement of people globally. So overall, what I'm saying is that we have an opportunity. The context that came with us to COVID-19 is one of a globalist capitalist system, which has privileged the few and institutionally marginalised the many. We have an opportunity to forge a way forward because the communities that have been oppressed are also now required to almost be part of that oppression. And in doing so, I think, and my final point is that we do need to look power and we look to the sort of change. We need to look to the sort of change that we're trying to create. Is it change just in how we individually behave so that we do self-help? Is it a push for change in procedures and practice? Is it a push for change in policy and legislation? Or is it a push for change also in the overall thinking and ideological frameworks that inform our action, which demands dismantling and understanding the ones that we have at the moment? Thank you very much.
It's quite simply fantastic to listen to, and I'm going to have to listen back to that because I can't write fast enough to get all the rich points down there. Which women and which politics and in whose interest, I think, is a quote that will resonate from that input, and I can see that in the chat. So thank you very much. Listen, there's going to be a rich discussion about this, guys, but we don't have time for it right now because we need to take a break. So just to say thank you very much to all of our panelists for their amazing inputs.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Don't forget to check out our website for more. Until the next time.